So, welcome to the second of three special podcasts leading up to our conference in Copenhagen in November. The title of the event and of these podcasts is Measurement in 2030. We're already halfway through this decade, so what does the next decade have in store? In our first panel, published last month, we focused on transparency and auditing. And in our final panel in September, we'll be looking at the direction of travel for the measurement currencies themselves. But today, our focus is very much on skills and on structure, organisation. We're going to explore the skills, talent, and organisation that we're going to need for measurement to survive and thrive in the 2030s. Now, measurement serves many purposes. Certainly, the buying and selling of advertising is a vital use case, but revenue is also driven by subscriptions, public service license fees, programme and format sales, all of which need to track performance and competitive activity. So, what are the skills, talent, and expertise, and the tools like data science, AI, and IT that measurement will need to survive and thrive? And what are the implications for the whole shape of our industry, for the measurement suppliers, for media owners, and for advertisers and for agencies? And all that in hopefully under an hour. So, firstly, I'm going to ask our panel just to briefly introduce themselves. So, firstly, Sushmita.
Hello everyone, I'm Sushmita. I am Product Director, Data Science. I joined Kantar Media more than 10 years back as a data scientist, and one of my first tasks was to build a solution for integrating panel with BVOD tagged census data. We delivered the solution in Netherlands in 2015, followed by Dovetail in UK. So I can only say that I have been in love with this industry ever since.
Oh, Sarah?
Hello, I'm Sarah Messer, currently independent as of the last few months, and that's an exciting journey I'm taking. But prior to that, I've been in the media industry, always in data and research and analytics for 27 years. 14 of those were spent inside media owners in the UK, and then 13 years, last 13 years, I've been managing director of Nielsen Media in the Middle East and Africa.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Saku Sahramies, and I'm working for MTV, which is the leading commercial broadcaster in Finland, and also working for actually for TV4 Sweden, as we have the same owner. My title is a director of ad product development, and I have focus of making our ad offering kind of a future proof, not kind of a in daily. I'm not planning for next year. And it's my two focus areas at the moment that I'm trying to digitalize our terrestrial and cable broadcast TV, linear TVs, so we can be really future-proof there, and also making sure that our measurements are up to date with our product roadmap. In addition to my daily job, I'm a board member of Media Metrics Finland, which, for example, produces the spot on cross-platform video advertising measurement in Finland that unifies TV and in-stream video.
Oh, Jonathan.
Hi, everybody. My name is Jonathan Wells. For the last 13 years, I've been working at Nielsen in a variety of work roles, crossing our engineering department, our data science department, and most recently working with a team that focuses on our internal measurement standards and compliance. So a lot of the audit work, a lot of the process and control work, a lot of the sort of quality management pieces of Nielsen. That's why I'm here.
Samir?
Hello,
Hello.
I'm Samir. I work at ITV and I look after what we rather grandly call our outcome measurement innovation team. Before that, variously, media agencies, Google running data science analytics teams. Also, I suppose, relevantly for this, I'm on the technical advisory boards of both UCOM and maybe more eyebrow-raisingly, the HALO project.
And Josh.
Hi, my name is Josh Chasen. I'm an American. I have, wait, is that not obvious? Is that the thing? You can probably tell from my dulcet tones, I know. I spent a lengthy amount of time at the start of my career at Arbitron. I was chief research officer at Comscore for 13 years. I was chief measurability officer at VideoAmp for 4 years. For the last year and a half, I have operated my own consulting practice called Not Simpler. I'm trying to move away from research in a sense. And so my soundbite is that Not Simpler is in the business of helping enterprises monetize data assets in the advertising analytics space. Notably, probably my largest client is Aquila, for whom I serve as chief research officer through Not Simpler. And so, since I'm the sort of like a chief research officer of Aquila on a contract basis for Richard, for the Brits in your audience, you can just think of me as the American Joe Louis.
Oh, okay. It's interesting you say moving away from research, because I think that's one of the themes we're going to be coming back to in our conversation about the future. But I wanted to leap right in with perhaps a link into our last panel, just to show that we don't throw these things together, that we had a plan. And at the end of that last panel, we asked our panelists what they thought the successful measurement company of the future would look like. I know you've had a chance to listen to that podcast, and hopefully most of our listeners have. So, Jonathan, as a practitioner at a measurement company, what was your reaction to their suggestions about what the future measurement company would actually look like?
Thanks, Richard. Look, there was certainly a lot to unpack in that podcast, and a lot of ground was covered. But I think the primary theme that I took away from the discussion was really a desire for accountability on the measurement company side of the house. Accountability as a mechanism to build trust. And fundamentally, I think what the panelists were talking about was using transparency as the wedge to do that. Transparency in terms of process, a lot of discussion about audits. Transparency in terms of measurement methodology, which I know we're going to talk a little bit about today, as well as the effectiveness of the service itself. Is it doing what it needs to do? Can the industries and markets have faith in what is being measured? In terms of the overall vision of where I think these sorts of companies are heading, obviously the scientific rigor remains the price of admission in whatever way you want to define that, whether it's research, whether it's data, whether it's, all of those different facets, I think still become the key elements of value driving that the measurement companies are going to provide. However, I think what we're also hearing and what we're starting to experience is a rise in the need for an improved customer experience. Lucia talked a lot about that, or mentioned that in the podcast when she was talking about the need to be able to explain all of these complex things really, really simply. So I think this is an important, and especially an important thing for us to think about, particularly as other media companies are starting to shrink their traditional research organizations. Decisions are starting to be made by people who maybe don't have that same research background and are making decisions based on, pricing, on sales targets, on some of those other things, which are all legitimate goals for those businesses to be pursuing. But I don't think there's as much institutional knowledge at large across the companies in terms of measurement rigor, measurement methodology, all those sorts of things. And so I think that's why this need for us to focus more and more on conversation, on partnership, whether that be through data sharing agreements or just problem solving, collectively. I think that's really, really important. In terms of the capabilities that I think we need to move to the future, and that the panelists talked about last go around, I still think that core statistical understandings remain important, and I hope we will debate a little bit of that today. But there is clearly a need for greater technical skills, for greater investments in data science capabilities that will enable trustworthy AI solutions, that will assist with data integrations and data harmonization, data cleansing, processing of data at scale. All of these things I think are going to remain incredibly important, but I do think the measurement company of the future is going to exhibit more focus on communication and on narratives and on storytelling, and really being able to describe not just the methodologies and where the data comes from, but also the insights that it produces, the outcomes that it creates. All of those things I think are going to be transitioning and transforming the measurement companies into to additional value-added opportunities for them to play more of a consultative role rather than just being the arbiter of a particular currency or a particular number.
We've got two client-side people on the panel in Saku and Samir. What was your reaction to that? Is that what you're looking for?
I think, maybe I'll start. I'm coming from a smaller market, so we can't have so much in-house skill sets. And we certainly need from an international kind of a complementary skill sets for our businesses. So I think, for example, the customer experience, that's a debate for any kind of a company that has a streaming or subscription business or whatever, it's a newspaper subscription. So I think it's, and the storytelling and the transparency, I think it's aligning with our interests.
I don't feel like I see very much from the community around, okay, broadly speaking, at a higher level, this is what we're seeing around the world. And these are some of the main debates and these are some of the main solutions. And if you want a point of view from us, it is this. And that kind of thought leadership, if you like, I think is something that could be done. This will be a theme of today. I think I worry a bit about sort of the fetishization, if I can say it properly, of statistics in the narrow sense. So yes, of course, some of the formal technical achievements of various mathematicians over the years, whether central limit theorem or whatever else, are beautiful things and lovely and important. But there's so much else in the wider sort of modeling and analysis world that is going on. And even you know, some of the formal improvements that have been achieved in the economics world, you know, the use of instrumental variables, all those sorts of things. And that's where I think sometimes the people with a sort of capital R research hat on will default to, well, the answer is we're going to fit a bunch of parametric distributions. And I know there are people on this call who know there's much more to it than that. But that's at the margins, that's what I'm seeing happen in some debates. And people are sort of clinging to the traditional approaches. Well, we've always fitted a negative binomial here, so why would we do anything different? I can give you a few reasons, one of which is that if you look at the data, it doesn't look anything like that these days. So maybe we should chat. Sorry, very long answer. But yes.
Can I take a cut at this one, Richard? Yeah. In the world of what an audience measurement firm is going to look like, and the reason that I mentioned earlier, oh, I'm an American, is simply because I believe that the U.S. is somewhat of an anomalous market globally. And so I want to be clear that perhaps the things that I've observed are not necessarily generalizable. So with that caveat on everything I say from now to the end of the podcast. So in the beginning, we had broadcast, first radio and then television, which involved putting a big stick in a field and sending out waves. And now you had no idea who was listening or watching. Consumption was a priori unknown. So we needed to build feedback loops. We need to build samples, basically. We needed to ask people or collect with technology from people what they were watching or listening to. In a world of streaming, viewing is no longer a priori unknown. Now, we can quibble with whether sending an impression to a device constitutes viewing, but we can count how many of those happened, right? So the role, I believe, and I'm seeing it here, the role of the audience measurement provider is changing because we no longer are required to count audiences, the more audiences are delivered digitally through streaming and other digital technologies, the less we need somebody to field a sample to tell us who's doing what and how often. So now we have many big data assets, smart TV data, set-top box data, but also, you know, census level streaming data, from server logs. So the most profound lesson that I took from my 4 years at VideoAmp was that in a world of big data where much behavior is now a priori known, the value proposition that the audience measurement company needs to bring to the table is very much tied to identity, because we have data assets. Google knows how many streams they served and to whom, and Facebook knows, and Sky knows, and NBCUniversal knows. But you, as the advertiser, don't know who all of that works together. So you need to map this data to an identity spine so you can combine it and deduplicate it. So my takeaway when I was at VideoAmp is that identity, and I still believe this, is the core linchpin of audience measurement in a big data environment. And I also kind of feel like we collectively, as an industry, were so enamored of big data that we kind of blew right past how important identity was. But if you don't have an identity spine to pin that big data to, you can't really use it. So I think that what's going to happen is the focus of audience measurement companies is going to be less on creating primary data and more on integrating and combining big data assets. And I think that's a profound sea change.
Which means, Sarah, does that accord with your experiences?
Yeah, I mean, it's been interesting to hear. I think I know I'll come on later on to talk a little bit more about the skills that I think people are still required in the future. And interesting to hear there's a lot of overlap in what I was going to talk about. But I certainly think one of the things that I was mulling over while we've been talking about all of this is that who owns the data? And so we have these massive super data sets like out there, like in these massive super black holes sucking everything in and everything up. And we now have with the AI tools and so on, we now have the ability to be in interpreting those massive data sets, but who owns it? How are we going to get into them? How are the primary data market research suppliers, the big data suppliers, actually going to be able to put all these together? And I think that's a huge question, because if the data can be out there, but if actually nobody can pull it together into one data warehouse that everybody can that can be analyzed and looked at, I think the it's going to stagnate. How do we move forward from that?
So I'm going to move on, having looked at the sort of supplier side, to looking at the actual client side. And now we haven't got advertisers or agencies on the call deliberately, because we would be here for hours if we were trying to cover the whole ecosystem. But we have got media owners on the call. And Saka, you mentioned the Spot On system, which you've bought in Finland, which is obviously had implications, I think, for how MTV actually organizes itself and in terms of how it handles data and the challenges there. Can you speak a bit about what impact new data and big data sets like ad server data have had on MTV?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and as you mentioned, I'm coming from a broadcaster, and I'm talking from a broadcaster perspective. But honestly, I think the skill set or the things we do, it's pretty much similar in radio business or print business and et cetera. So it's not necessarily always broadcaster specific. And it's I think the living in a kind of a big small market broadcaster, there is a vast amount of data need from different department that needs to be filled. And it's for us, it's for example, what can we in-house and what we cannot in-house? It's always a big question that we need to have a lot of skill sets within our company, but we'll need to have a close decision every time we are facing a new challenge in data, that should we acquire it somewhere from vendor or create it by ourselves. And when it comes to the kind of a, for example, for advertising sales, when we introduced the Spot On, which is a kind of a unified trading currency also between the broadcast TV and our BVOD services, streaming services, so it creates a new kind of challenges for us. For example, campaign optimization. We traditionally optimize the linear TV campaigns with our certain optimization tools, and a digital ad server, video ad server, optimize the digital campaigns. But we need to optimize the whole campaign entity in order to get the kind of the holistic campaign delivery for clients, fulfilling the needs of a reach for a client, but also taking into account our inventory that we utilize in a smart way to get maximum amount of course, money out of it. But it's as a streamer, we are facing kind of for streaming services, and we have very ambitious SVOD goals also, and we are the biggest local player there. So it brings a lot of course, data challenges. So we need to utilize our first-party data better and better all the time for personalization, for recommendation, to create better customer experience. As Jonathan told, that's a very key area for us to measuring. What is the customer experience? So how can you improve it? How can you reduce churn from our subscriptions? And and we need new skill sets, what we haven't traditionally had, like what is the price elasticity of our different subscription tiers? We haven't had those back in the days. Mm. And as mentioned, I think advertising is shifting fastly towards digital. And it's in addition to the campaign delivery, for example, we are starting to have a self-service advertising buying tools for smaller advertisers. So it's a kind of an analytics we need like any other kind of an online store, which hasn't been in core of a broadcasting business before. So there are number of cases. There is a lot of implications to our data functions with the new world and a lot of skill sets.
Mm. When we were talking earlier about the panel, one of the things Samir mentioned to me, which is something that I've always been very interested in, is how you organize, particularly media owners, I think, in terms of whether you have a centralized data team where you have all your skills in one central organization serving the whole company, or whether you decentralize and actually have the specialists, you know, close to where the action is within the teams. Having been around for a worrying amount of time, I've seen some of my clients over the course of 5 or 6 years gradually oscillate towards centralizing because it will save money, and then gradually oscillating back towards embedding because it's too centralized and costing too much money. Do we think the future is going to be more decentralized, given that seems to be the way that technology, you know, things like distribution and decentralization, or are there going to be still whatever we call them, research data, but still large data teams where it makes more sense for people to be together?
Well, if I start from our perspective, it's of course I think the overall thing is that whoever works within the data, AI, machine learning, they need to be more skilled with our business challenges. So they can't be just the ones who know the modeling and et cetera. They need to understand better our business challenges. So that's kind of indicates that it could be a bit more kind of a decentralized version of, but it's also if we have a handful from a small market, if we have eight data engineers and scientists, it's easy to be centralized, but they are spreading across the different department with a special skill. So I would say it's, from our perspective, I would say that they most likely be centralized, but they are focusing on some business areas. But we can't really decentralize eight people, for example.
So maybe
ITV has a different view on this, but it's...
Where are you on that pendulum of centralized versus...
We've ended up doing both for some of the same reasons that have been mentioned, which is that, you know, particularly when you're hiring reasonably rare skill sets and when you possibly can't pay them as much as other people can, then you've got to make it appealing in other ways. And one of the ways that managers of data teams often do that is you huddle them together, and at least they feel like there's some sort of job ladder that they can climb, some sort of sense of community. And then, Saki was saying, you then matrix them out to the different business units, and maybe you put a sort of a domain expert in front of them who then acts as a bridge between, for example, the commercial team and the central data team. So that's part of what we do. So the outcome stuff that I work on, we took a decision to put the team inside the commercial org. So rather than have it be part of a central pool of data scientists and analysts and others, we said, okay, we're going to have a group of, sorry to sort of nod to the stereotype, but a group of reasonably not sales-like people in a sales org. Does that give me some interesting management challenges? Yeah, absolutely. Is it worth it? Yes, because what it means is that they are very close to the place where the questions are being asked. And so what we found is that that lets you iterate a lot more quickly because, we'll be developing a measurement product, let's say, but in my case, outcome measurement, so business impact. And the first 10 or 15 meetings that we have with advertisers after we've managed to get something working at all are incredibly useful. And it's incredibly useful to have the technical people in those meetings because they listen and they go, oh, no one's asked me that before. Hang on. Okay. So you want it to look like this chart because then that lets you have a conversation with finance. Yeah, I can do that. On a good day, we look really cool because we do it in the meeting and then somebody sets a query running and then goes, ta-da, is this what you meant? And they say, oh, yeah, brilliant. That's clever. And that I don't think we could do if we were part of the wider central data org, because we just wouldn't have the same velocity of improvement. And where you've got stuff that is uncertain, I think we've probably all done, I've done this. I've been in teams which have been too far removed. And you just get a bit ivory tower and a bit sort of, oh, we know what the customer needs better than they do. Spoiler alert, no, you don't.
Presumably, it
So,
also
yeah.
your point, it also helps with retention because, people have joined a TV company. They want to be reminded they are actually at a TV company surrounded by people doing TV as opposed to being in a, in a basement stuck with all the other sort of
Yeah,
research.
that's a good shout. One of the team took full advantage of that. So he went to all of the sort of the events where we have talent from the different shows and went round and collected a whole load of signatures from famous people that he had grown up with on his screen. So no, I think that's absolutely true.
I think there's a slightly, I think I agree with you, Samir, in terms of the location of competence, right? And the co-location of competence is really what it feels like to me. And I think it's about surrounding people with skill sets that are similar to their own, because that's how you learn and that's how you grow. And I think that notion of a ladder or a career path is also really, really important. And so I think what we see is that we organize around competence. And I think, Samir, the example that you talk about in terms of co-locating a particular group of technical individuals in a sales team is great. I would argue that not every technical person would sit or would fit in a team like that, right? So there's a skill set that comes with people who are going to be successful based on where they sit within the organization. But the analogy that I would draw is, I think, but coming back to what we've talked about already, is that there's still an element internally of a customer experience there as well, the need to collaborate. So the organizational structure, I think, becomes less relevant. And I think we learned that a lot during COVID as well. What does become important is the skill set and the need for a distributed workforce or a centralized workforce to talk to one another, given that our businesses have become so complex, so interoperable, so interdependent, that without that human skill set of being able to talk and connect and collaborate, I think that's where the real risks sit, not necessarily whether it's a centralized or a decentralized organization.
Hey, a quick question for you, gentlemen, because you mentioned COVID, Jonathan. Where does working from home versus coming to the office sit right now, with your companies?
Oh, good
So
question.
Nielsen's perspective right now is we remain a decentralized organization from that perspective. There are no work from office mandates. There's nothing like that. But what we are finding is that teams are starting to gravitate towards some period of time together, mm-hmm. right? And it's interesting to sort of observe that sort of come up organically, where people, I think, enjoy the ability to work from home, but they also are starting to recognize what they are missing from those serendipitous hallway conversations, those things that spark ideas and spark different thoughts. So we're sort of seeing a convergence start to happen in a more ad hoc fashion. And I think people are just realizing the value in being together.
Sushmita?
Yeah, I think it's maybe more for technical teams to come together and discuss, because it is so much easier when you have a whiteboard and you can write things down and work out a solution. It's not the same when you are, you know, it's when it's not a face-to-face meeting. So we do that, you know, all the brainstorming session or working on pitches or working on a new client request. We do gather all the people together, and, you know, a lot comes out of it when people are in one room and you have a whiteboard.
We do have a kind of a office first policies kind of a, at the moment. We didn't have a after COVID, but then there was a group of people who never got to office, and it's kind of a, then everyone was that office first, which means, let's say, 3 days minimum at the office. So that's it has its pros and cons as anything, but I think it is good for the spirits, and it's good for a kind of a cross-functional collaboration to meet people you trust. It's a typical human nature also.
And I think it's as important externally for the clients, the JICs, the people that we are interacting with as suppliers, as individuals on a daily basis, to see them in person as well. It isn't always possible. I mean, we often have a supplier working with a team in a different country, with an auditor spread across two or three different countries. It isn't all possible to be in the room in every single meeting. But I think you have to have moments in time where you come together to work together, because I think it's when you look into somebody's eye and you have those conversations that the real work gets done.
It's also
a real understanding.
I could do a whole podcast on working from home, but also I do worry that people who are joining an industry for the first time, just being in an office and absorbing what that company does. And I know some friends of mine who joined a new company during COVID and were completely alienated because they didn't really get a feel for what that company did until COVID was over. And they were actually overhearing conversations, seeing what other people in the office were doing. But as I say, we could do a deep dive on that. But I'm conscious of really focusing on...
Richard, maybe one other just little thing, which is sometimes the flexibility is a retention tool.
Yeah.
So for us, the answer is both, because I, you know, as a median paying organization, if I put it like that, you know, we have to have other things that we can offer. And if I can say to someone, okay, we'll do 2 days in the office, even though everybody's generally doing three or whatever, is that okay? And in return for that, I get that flexibility, I get to keep people who maybe otherwise wouldn't stay.
Yeah, very good point. One of the topics that we touched on in the first panel fleetingly was data science, and we didn't deliberately do a deep dive on it then, as I really wanted to try and weave it into this particular panel. Now, Sushmita, as a data scientist, it's a very existential question, but what is the difference between what you do and a statistician does and a researcher does? Or am I just compartmentalizing those terms? What's the role that data science plays, do you think?
Three researchers, statisticians, and data scientists. So I think, of course, they all need to work together in order to deliver the best solution and understand the market and have the best outcome. Researcher out of the three, I would say, probably is the broadest term. I'd say researcher is someone who has a strong domain knowledge, understands audience measurement, understand what the client is asking for, how they're going to use the final data set that we deliver to the client, have a high level understanding of all the end-to-end solutions, so from panel recruitment to metering technology to methodology to, you know, data being delivered, reporting tool, and the whole big picture. Whereas I think out of the three, a statistician probably is the most well-defined. So, it would include designing panel recruitment, panel controls, looking at the establishment survey, sampling, weighting, sample size for each cell. And that is extremely important and still the core of our industry to have a panel data that we can trust that will be the source of truth no matter what methodology is being applied later on. And then the data scientist, I think, should have statistical mathematical skills and also coding coding skills, should also keep up with, the latest that's in this area, whether it's machine learning, it's AI, it's large language models or probabilistic approaches. So data scientist, I think, is a more flexible skill set, a more varied skill set from probability to mathematics to AI to creating an MVP, a solution end to end, prototyping it, on their own machines. So they should be able to do all of that. And then moving on to your second question, which was the role of data science. I think data science plays different roles from innovating, creating new solutions, understanding what's out there in the market, what's the need, where are the holes, where we can have more solutions that can help the client bring more value to their own data sets, et cetera. Or it could be improving existing solutions. Or it could be just adding speed and efficiency to the operations. And then also, as we spoke about, creating global solutions, but that cater to local needs. So optimizing these solutions by understanding the local markets and the local behavior in that country. So let me illustrate this and share an example with you on what role of data science would be in a typical project like integration of panel with big data. So it starts from the pitching phase, which is like step zero. So we get an RFP, a request for proposal. A lot of the times, these proposals are not like standard proposal. Clients are asking for something different. We have these data sets, and this is how you can access them. This is the cloud service we want you to use. We don't want all of these data sets to be in one place. They are going to be, 10 different ways to access 10 different data sets. So it is designing the methodology, understanding all of the pipeline and the ecosystem. And then, of course, during the pitching process, to collaborate with the product team, business development, finance, commercial, and prepare a response to RFP. And then finally, going to the client site most of the time to basically clear the fog, present the complex methodology in the simplest of ways. So, the art of storytelling plays an important role here. And then, well, the next phase, assuming we've won this project, is to develop the solution and deploy the solution. So once all the input data is available, validating all the data set, whether it's coming from, internally or externally, whether it's the panel data or it's first party data, it's almost like a validation check that we do and provide feedback. Similar to like an internal audit, maybe that was mentioned in the previous podcast. So, and once when the boxes are ticked and the input data is checked, then we would implement the solution using whatever coding language the team uses, and then work closely with the solution architects and in whatever cloud environment that is the most appropriate for that project. It can differ by market. And then work out the pipeline with product and technology teams. So once all of this is set up, we've implemented the solution, it's deployed, you have the pipeline, you have the data flowing through, which means the final outcome is available. So the final data set is available post the methodology being applied. Then again, a validation step comes in and QC report generation comes in. And then again, looking at that reports with the product team or the researcher who has good domain knowledge on, whether we have again ticked all the boxes. from an algorithm implementation perspective, but not just that, the usability of the data. It's not just one goal that we have when you're thinking of a mathematical or a machine learning model, right? No matter what the model is, the integrity of the panel data needs to be maintained. You know, what happens to the co-viewing behavior, viewer per view factors, the reach build, long-term reach, and all of those. So looking at the holistic side of things. And then once that's approved internally by the data science team, it then gets released to the client, and then we can go live in a market. And then, of course, that's where our role sort of almost like diminishes a bit because the product is live. But of course, once a service is live, we would still provide support because, you know, client queries and then change request, more data, more different kind of data coming in, and how it fits into the system, have to make a configurable system that's adaptive to changes, etc. So yeah, we are there for the lifetime of the project.
It's pretty extensive. I guess the not quite the elephant in the room, because it depends whether you see it as a tool or a threat, but certainly if you're on LinkedIn at the moment, everyone is obsessed with AI. To what degree, I'm going to ask Samir, I guess, this question, to what degree can what Sushmita has just described, can that be done by AI? How much of that needs a human being?
I mean, I was interested to hear Sushmita talk through that, because that's, I think that's an example of where the sort of the data science skill sets have been very closely harnessed to a kind of researcher and panel first focus, which in another way you can see as a focus on statistics primarily through distribution. So I think rather than a couple of things, I think there's AI and ML, you know, and everybody on this call, we've been doing good old-fashioned ML for decades in some cases. It's what changes really is nothing other than, there's that Gary Larson cartoon decades ago from The Far Side where somebody puts his hand up in class and says, "Please, sir, can I be excused? My brain is full." And, you know, some of the modeling types that we use very quickly reach that point, and they saturate and they can no longer learn anything else. But some of the latest kinds of, I'm just going to call it machine learning, I'm not going to say AI, so the latest kinds can absorb a lot more. They can absorb anything up to, you know, the output of billions of people around the world and still keep learning and keep getting better. I mean, they're still monstrously inefficient, and the sort of, you know, if human children learned as slowly as LLMs do, then, you know, we'd all still be in education right now and learning and scarcely able to speak, but thankfully we're not. So I think there's an underlying thing here between the different modeling cultures, and Leo Bryman did a paper on this a while ago, sort of big turn of the century, I think it was, modeling, statistical modeling, the two cultures. And it opens with this lovely, quite affectionate piss take of the sort of paper you'd see in the statistical journals, where essentially the statistician says, "We assume the data are drawn from the following distributions, i.e. we've gone, we reckon that this is a Poisson process or whatever, and therefore it's like this, and so we can apply all this wonderful, you know, mathematical," sorry folks, I am, apologies to those of you listening at home, I am finding a space where I can at a hotel, so I kind of have to let them be here, but the flip side is all the furniture being moved. Anyway, so he sort of teases this approach to stats, where you sort of know in advance what you think the functional forms will be, and then the data is merely something that lets you tune your model. And then you get the sort of machine learning crowd who come in and go, "Well, I don't know what's going on inside, but it predicts like fuck, so brilliant. Let's use that." And on both sides of that, you know, they're, I think in the TV world, that if you call yourself a researcher, you probably smile on the first kind and frown at the second. And that is the thing that I think needs to change, because I think there's, and this is slightly what Josh is saying as well, which is that there's too much of a focus on one way of of approaching these sorts of large-scale data problems. And what's changing in the end, and Jonathan can speak to this as can Sarah, what's changing in the end is the things that people need to do with this stuff. And when that changes, you've got to change your approaches. Because I'll give you one practical example and then I'll shut up. But if you're doing lift measurement, so some sort of causal experimentation where some people were dosed, some people were undosed, what difference did it make? Then there are things that you can tolerate in terms of maybe a fairly grubby panel, but you absolutely wouldn't if what you're doing is professional counting. If you want to know that it's a seven and it really, really is a seven in a very auditable way, and you can go and visit the home of one of the people who said it was a seven, that's fine. But if you're not doing that, if you're doing lift, then a lot of the assumptions that came in the 70s and 80s when some of this stuff was being thrashed out no longer apply. And I think sometimes we confuse the sort of the surface features of the approach with what we're actually trying to do, which is help people make decisions and do other things.
I have to jump in. And Samir, I think you're, again, I'm vigorously agreeing with you, but I think there's a clarity that needs to be provided here. And if I may quote my Australian idol icon, Tim Minchin, this is all about science, right? And science adjusts its view based on what's observed. And I think what we're doing now is we're entering a world where this proliferation of data, and we've talked about it as fragmentation and all of these other things, is a new element, right? That we didn't have access to, that didn't exist before. So I don't think that, and I don't think anybody here is suggesting that that negates the statistical rigor and all of those things, but I think we have to think about these things in aggregate and in combination. If you were talking to a measurement provider 10 years ago, they didn't have data scientists, they had measurement scientists, right? And then as part of our need to recruit and as part of our need to stay current, we kind of transitioned into, well, now we have data science organizations. My contention, at the risk of being a little bit pithy, is that in fact, what this industry needs is measurement and data scientists, mad scientists, if you will, who can actually leverage the best available data and the best available techniques. And I don't think that the one struggle that I have with the AI conversation is, again, it comes back to that quote, AI is only as good as the data that it's trained on and what it learns and how it learns. And that learning fundamentally is based on observation. Observation, and particularly in the media space, is about human behaviors, right? That's what you need to understand in order to be able to apply the science, which is fundamentally there to address bias and error, right? And we want the best possible solutions to address that bias and error. Some of that is constrained by legacy science, let's say, science that has evolved. But I don't think that that means that big data is necessarily the panacea. And nor do I suggest anybody here is saying that. I think Josh was right when he talked about identity having kind of not been really looked at enough in recent times, and that being a core to unlock some of these things as we think about cross-platform. But you can't get away from the fact that we still need to base all of these solutions on observed behavior and on observed things, observable things, because that's what's going to feed the models, which will make all of this data and all of this analysis and all of these insights more efficient.
But even there, as you're saying that, there's an element of kind of leaning towards certain forms of approach, and that's the bit that I worry about, because
I think
it's
it's all
not
things.
science. I'm going to give you some other Australians. So the two Australian doctors who for years were saying, we think you're wrong about stomach ulcers. You're all saying that stomach ulcers are a function of stress and acid production. But we treat them with antibiotics and it works. And they were, ignored for ages. And it took them a very long time to convert the scientific establishment. And unfortunately, I think in the audience research world, we have an equivalent, which is the people wielding the parametric negative binomial distribution are the ones that currently are the elder statespeople in our various organizations, and they're the ones that are looking at these other approaches, like, I don't know, gradient boosting or whatever, I don't care, and going, oh, no, that's not the right kind of science. That's like saying that stomach ulcers are caused by a bacterium. That's more the issue I have. But
Yeah,
in practice, we're enthralled to a certain kind of statistician.
I think there is truth in that, Samir, and I'm not suggesting that any one domain of this scientific boundary is prescient or primal over another. But I do think there is an education issue going on here as well. To your point, the folks that rely heavily on these scientific measures, there's two reasons that it happens, right? One is these are the folks that still have a lot of influence in the industry and in where the industry is going. And second, the difference between the statistical models and the AI models, the statistical models are very easy to understand, right? There's a lot of history behind that, and people gravitate towards what they understand. There's a bit of a leap of faith when you start moving into the black boxes. And I think it will evolve, right? I do believe we're going to get to a point where there will be more of an equilibrium, but I don't think we're there yet. But that's why conversations like this are important. Josh, I can see your hands up.
Yeah, I just want to offer two, I guess, contrarian perspectives on on a couple of things that have been said. One is that I find myself wary of the soundbite, which we've all heard, that panels represent a source of truth. I think panels tell us things that big data assets don't. But for example, if Google tells me that their campaign served 10 million impressions, and the panel projection tells me it's 8 million, I'm going to believe the 10 million. So I just think we have to be careful in characterizing something from the panel as the source of truth. Panels tell us things like overlap and duplication, which we can't get from big data assets. The other thing is, I'm a little bit surprised at how many of you are talking about storytelling as an important component of the talent profile for measurement companies moving forward? This may be a distinctly American perspective, but when it comes to data and findings and creating stories, I tend to think of the process as story finding as opposed to storytelling. And that's perhaps because there have been software tools for quite some time that are quote unquote story finders. In other words, show me all the places I'm number one. But in the world of story finding, which is to say, creating narratives from data, AI is going to do that so fast your head would spin. I mean, I think that's the first thing that's going to go. Is human beings to turn math into English, right? I mean, AI is going to be finding and telling your stories really quickly.
Sarah, we were going to
I mean,
like.
AI can write a novel for crying out loud.
Yes, but it wouldn't be a very good one, would it? Sarah,
Segue.
storytelling, that sounds like your sort of topic, but.
Yeah. Totally. I mean, I think that it's been interesting. I think there are three things, and I'll come into what Joshua says as well. There are three things that I wanted to talk about, all of which have come up repeatedly in since we started this conversation, in terms of the skills that are going to be important. And storytelling is, I think, is very much one of them. And Joshua, I totally understand what you're saying about story finding. And I think what these tools enable us to do is to synthesize and look across large swathes of data. And come up with some high level summaries, some trends. What they can't do is tell us why or how. And it's that age old difference between quantitative and qualitative data sets, right? Qualitative, and that's where the human element comes in, is that ability to kind of take a high level data set, take a report, take a summary, and go, well, what does that mean? How do we interpret that for a JIC? For an advertiser, for a marketeer to make a decision and an action that will actually have a successful outcome. And I'm not sure that we're at a point yet where any of these tools can replace that human interaction. And we were talking a bit earlier even about face-to-face, right? Being face-to-face with people. A robot, a machine, cannot interpret the nuance of body language, of looking into somebody's eye in a meeting and actually being able to read what they aren't saying. And I think that is also the human element of storytelling and influence, right? And so I think that's going to be really important. The other two things that I think have come up repeatedly is collaboration. Machines don't collaborate in the way that humans can. And I think both Samir and Jonathan, even Saku, have talked about we have, decentralization, centralized across different teams, diversity. We need people that success in the future is going to come from collaboration. It's going to come from better ways of working together. And that's a very human-led skill. And the third thing I want to talk about was strategic thinking. And this really comes back to something Samir was saying much earlier on, which is about that global thinking. And actually, I think, Samir, you were kind of using it in a bit of a stick to say, why are the big research suppliers, big data suppliers, not giving us more global insights? It's a fair point. But actually, that ability to connect dots across, you know, across platforms, across events, across world happenings, and being able to connect those dots in a strategic way, again, is not what a machine will do. They will look across the data that we have and tell you what that data says, but not connect it to the bigger picture. And I think that's a very human thing as well. So that's they are the skills. Not on top of data science, data warehousing, all of those things are going to still be very important. I think these skills are going to be really critical going forward.
One of the things
I just want to say, this isn't actually me. This is my agent.
One of the things I talked about at the ASI back in November was there's an additional aspect to storytelling, which is the storytelling involved in if we are moving to this world where we have more complex systems, we have algorithms, we have ad server data combined with panels, combined with all, you know, vid models, all this sort of stuff. The clients who are using the data need to have it explained to them in a understandable way why they should trust this in the first place. And I know, Saku, you've moved over to a fairly groundbreaking system for post-campaign evaluation in Finland. How are you getting the clients to understand what you probably would need a degree in data science to actually really understand? How are you actually telling people the story that they should trust this data in a way that is slightly different from when you just said, okay, people just have a people meter and they press a button to say they're there? We've moved way beyond that now, haven't we?
Yeah, I think it's first of all, it's a people and trust what comes. So they don't doubt, for example, us from Finnish broadcasters. We know all the buyers. It's a small market to start with. So they trust us. That's the first, I think, a pillar of a thing why it's easier to come with such a groundbreaking research and a trading currency. What we are trading, our BWAT currencies, with a kind of a co-viewings from a source of truth, as Susmita say, from the panels. But I think it's easy for our buyers to understand ad server data. It's a census data, how we serve ads to devices. Mm-hmm. It's a census data where we have registered information, demographics, which is then panel told who are the actual viewers from that campaign. Because in our streaming service, there's only one logged in people and anyone can watch. So I think we have explained it in a quite kind of a with a real life examples from what is the composition in a household viewing this. Hey, why there is typically, we don't have many kind of a different user profiles within our streaming service. So there is a person viewing in house with a, let's say a man is viewing streaming service with a wife's registration data, and that's why it's not equally coming. And I think it's pretty practical examples how we do it. We haven't done it kind of from a very, let's say, the algorithm. We haven't explained the algorithms and that. I think they come with the trust.
Mm. Sarah, I'm conscious of time, so I've got one more question, and then I will try and wrap up within 10 minutes, if that's all right with people, because we're borrowing your time, I'm very much aware. But Sarah, you had your hand up.
Yeah, I was going to say very quickly, and I wonder, one thing we haven't really touched upon is how much of this is a generational gap, right? So us old fogies that have been brought up in a very, you know, research methodological world are absolutely, will ask every question and want to know exactly what can we trust, how was this built, where did this come from? But the generation that are coming into the workplace now within our industry come from a very different background, and I don't know if they that their trust is based in asking the same kind of questions, is based in, you know, that desire to really get to the center. And actually, maybe we will come to a point in the future where we want to be more complex. We want to explain the complexity more because people are too willing to go, well, somebody said that number and therefore it must be correct.
Yeah, I've used the analogy before that my dad would see it as an admission of defeat if he had to go to the garage to have his car repaired. He'd have a good go at trying to fix it first. I don't think that world exists anymore. The cars are basically computers, and you take them in and let an expert work out what's going on. But
I think
it's
there's a place where that particularly shows up, which we haven't touched on maybe, which is advertisers. So we our center of gravity tends to be the large advertiser, large agency world, because generally that's who pays for our stuff. But one of the lovely things about being ITV has been to see the part of the business that leans into the small advertisers who are currently all in on Google and Meta. And were underserved and or not served at all by TV as a medium. And their starting point, as Sarah says, is very different. It's okay, these are the numbers that I get in the reporting platform. I know they must be vaguely true because I've given them my sales data. Yes, I can see there's a bit of double counting, but broadly speaking, when I steer my business by these numbers, I make more money. And I like money, so that's good. And so I don't really care that much about the way that these numbers are put together. If they work for me, then they work, and that's good enough. And even in the sort of larger client side, I'm seeing now, really senior advertisers who've come up through the ranks, and they regard this telly thing as frankly just a bit weird and a bit of an oddity. And what do you mean I can't change things every 5 minutes? What do you mean I can't see what's happening 5 minutes after I set it live? That's absurd. Every medium does that. And that is another way in which we, I do worry about our bit of the industry and the sort of, not the smugness exactly, but the sort of the belief that we have it all sorted. And if only people would do things the way that we told them, then they'd all be fine. It's like, in the long run, we're all dead, as Kane said. And yet sometimes our answer is, no, you just need to be patient. They haven't got time for patience. Trying to make money and not get clobbered by the tariffs and not go out of business. That's a today problem, not a
Well,
next year problem.
you mentioned
I have
the
a friend whose daughter said, his little girl said to him, "Daddy, I hate patience."
tariff. Well, you've both all been very patient in allowing me to overrun slightly. I've got just got one final question, which I'll pose to Josh initially, but I'd be interested in your view on this because it has particular relevance, I think, for Susmita at Jonathan working in research agencies. But perhaps it's a bit of a controversial one. But going forward, what implications does all we've talked about have for how the, for want of a better word, research and data industry is going to be structured going forward? Will data science teams be part of the research function as Susmita's team is at the moment, or in 10 years' time, will the research teams be reporting into Susmita's division because there'll be data science companies with research arms? How is this going to play out? Is data, I'm not, don't want to have this as like, is data science going to win or is research going to win? But how are these going to come together?
They're not going to come together. It's not two things that will merge. It's an evolution. I think that research and the toolkit of research, things like surveys and panels and focus groups and ethnographic research, that were the toolkit that we used to obtain knowledge in order to make decisions that, in a business context, were better decisions. Now, we are we and by the way, when that stuff was developed, we didn't have big data assets, we didn't have data science, we didn't have the tools and the technologies. So I remember in 1999 I was working for an online research company, and I was working on a pitch with the founder, and she said to me, "Don't call it research. If we call it research, they'll think they don't need it." So, and you see that, research functions are now being called insights, right? Consumer insights. I've seen companies that used to have chief research officers now have chief data officers. That's the thing, right? The whole point of research, traditional historical research, has been to make data, because absent the research, there wasn't any, okay? Now, you can't swing a dead cat without creating data, especially if the cat's wearing a Fitbit. So we are lousy with data, okay? Research emerged of an era when we had no data. We had to make it if we wanted it. Now we are lousy with data. And the thing we need to do is turn that data, glean insights from it, deploy it, make it useful. So the discipline of research, I believe, is in the process of morphing into the discipline of data science.
Rita, that sounds positive for your future.
I'm pulling for you.
We have the same team for statisticians and data science because I think they are very closely knit together. It's all mathematics and statistics as a base. We see researchers as somebody who's got overall end-to-end knowledge, and we actually go with questions to the researchers. This is what we are doing. This is how it's going to impact the data. What do you think about this? So I think, again, all of these need to work together. Yes, research is a slightly different domain. You need to be the best in that field in terms of understanding the dynamics and the ecosystem, what's the requirement, where it's heading towards, and the bigger picture. So I think that is still going to stay because the data scientists that we hire, they don't necessarily have the domain knowledge to start with, right? It builds on as you stay in this industry, talk to the researchers, work on different projects. So I think it does it really matter who gets subsumed in what? I think all of these people just need to work together.
I did while Josh was talking, I did a quick Google, and the according to the Cambridge Dictionary, the definition of a researcher is someone who studies a subject in order to discover new information or reach a new understanding. So I guess part of the problem is it is redefining what we mean by a researcher. In Sushmita's definition, it's quite a broad strategic overall thing. But Jonathan?
Richard, look, I think it's a bit of a false argument, right, in terms of which will subsume which. The reality is we've got ever-increasing sets of data, we've got ever-evolving and maturing types of science and measurement and extrapolation, and what you call it doesn't really matter. As I said, 10 years ago, we were all measurement scientists. Now they're data scientists. 10 years from now, there'll probably be a different name. I think what is more important is, are these functions delivering value? Are they serving a need? Are they trustworthy? Are they transparent? All of these themes that we've touched on today, I think, are the important ones. And frankly, I don't know that we need to get too caught up in the names, but I think what was illuminating today was understanding the roles, right? And the different roles and the different skill sets that are required are actually the most important thing. What you call it whatever you like. As long as it's meeting a need and delivering value, that to me is what really we should be focused on.
I have a feeling Samir may have a science fiction analogy for us, but I may be wrong. Go for it, Samir.
Yes, I do. I actually do think the question is along the right lines, and really, I think Sushmita should be in charge. And what I mean by that is I think that we currently, when we say researcher, we are privileging a certain set of tools and techniques that, as Josh says, were absolutely vital at a certain point in the lives of our industry, and were important to get us to things that were both useful and true. And we've all been in marketing long enough to know that there are plenty of times when people do lots of storytelling that turns out to have no basis in reality. And the only reason we discover that is a year later when it turns out that building your strategy on that thing turned out to be a daft thing to do. And so if it is going to be subsumed, I think it's going to be absorbed in some way. And we've all seen these sci-fi movies where somebody, I think I'm sure it happens in the Matrix where you think that one thing's absorbing the other, and then it turns out that the other thing changes, or the absorbing entity changes as a result. And I think it's going to be one of those, which is that we've got to break out of this sort of prison of thinking of research as being the sort of primus inter pares in our world. And if that means that research has to get borged into the other things, then great. But what that will do is it will leave an imprint of concerns about representativity and extensibility of findings. That those will also be changed because they aren't, when you're no longer just counting stuff and delivering currencies of eyeballs, those things also have to change.
Okay.
One thing I would like to add, we need a kind of an all-rounder or generalist to understand how do we direct all these skills, whether it's a researcher, data scientist, or whatever it is, it's to serve our business needs. So there needs to be kind of a holistic understanding also from someone. So you can't be too specific. Everyone can't be two specialists. So there needs to be kind of a who representing jigs, selecting vendors, selecting the best methodology to solve a challenge. So that's my take on it.
Well, I'll give the final word to Sarah.
I was actually trying to think about my with my Nielsen hat on, kind of my most recent experience, and for the whole industry where we built for the TV measurement panel in Saudi Arabia, which is the first time I think a brand new never ex where a system has never existed before has been built in a country for many years. And I can honestly say data science were a part of every single conversation. They were part of the research, the operations. Nothing really happened without data science being in the middle of that. And I agree with Jonathan, how does that evolve and change? As long as people are kind of contributing and what people are called doesn't matter. But honestly, in that process, data science were in the heart of everything.
I think a lot of it does come down to names, as a couple of you have highlighted. A company I work for, I won't name, went through a phase when they were embarrassed about the phrase researchers. So they rebranded everyone to be consultants and then did a major pitch, which they lost. And I remember the CEO phoned up and said, "Why did we lose?" And they said, "Well, why did you send along consultants? Why didn't you just send along some of your own staff?" So, but it's a lot, it's all down to how you actually brand these things. I said that, and I don't want to get into the whole branding thing. Perhaps there is a challenge going forward here in terms of how we brand and describe job titles and what they actually are and do. It's quite interesting looking at LinkedIn to see some of the more ambitious job titles people sometimes have, but they're describing what they actually do as opposed to traditional jobs. But anyway, on that note, thank you very much indeed for taking part in the panel today. I know we've overrun and I've failed in my duty as the person running the panel, and I will go away and take action against myself for that. But in the meantime, we've got another panel coming up in September, which will be the third, which will very much focus on the currencies and the JICs, and we've teed up a lot of that conversation, I think, so lots for them to react to. But in the meantime, thanks everyone for taking part.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.